Yo, what's up, everybody? Today is December 10th, 2023. Sunday, December 10th, 2023. It's another episode of Real Sankara Hours, your favorite black leftist socialist, Pan-African socialist political podcast, where we talk about, news, current events from a black left perspective, particularly like a Pan-African socialist perspective. This is another free episode. Housekeeping, if you want to support us at Real Sankara Hours, our website is realsankarahours.org. It's going to be in the show description. For $5 a month, you can become a patron and listen to bonus episodes where we talk about black radical theory and other stuff. So, but anyway, yeah, we have a lot to talk about, so let's get right into it. Kissinger's dead.
Henry Kissinger. Let's start off with the good news. The good die young at the tender ripe age of, he clocked the century. It was the century of Kissinger. I don't know. People say like you have to hand it to him. You under no circumstances have to hand it to Henry Kissinger. I was going to say that usually the take around this stuff is like, why are you celebrating that he's dead? Because he won. He committed, an unfathomable amount of atrocities and got rich and is venerated by all the legacy media publications and shitty politicians in the swamp. Should not call it the swamp. That's an insult to swamps. Swamps are very life-giving biospheres. But anyway, they say that, but I mean, in my reaction, it was just like, finally. But I also think that there's a reason to be grateful, because there's something about like the passing of life where like that energy is transferred to, other people or to the universe. And this is a man who essentially ate like a million Cambodian souls, and he was holding on to them. I think it's good that they can be released finally. That's a little metaphysical, not very materialist, but I think there's some truth to that. And also, it's just nice to now live in a world where there's no Henry Kissinger, because that motherfucker was still giving interviews. Fucking Politico was like, I had no idea this was the last interview Henry Kissinger gave. Oh, and guess what Henry Kissinger's plan for the Israeli-Palestine conflict is? It's give the West Bank to Jordan. So, yes, also genocide of the Palestinian national identity. That, so it's nice to see that the guy, even in his old age, he hadn't lost his touch,
my only feelings on Kissinger is, well, rotten piss for that old motherfucker. He died November 29th at his home in Connecticut. He was 100 years old. He was a national security advisor and secretary of state for two presidents, including Richard Nixon. And yeah, he was responsible for, he was a chief architect for U.S. war policy in Southeast Asia from 1969 to 1975. And he was definitely responsible for expanding the U.S.'s secret war in Cambodia and the mass killings in Cambodia. And then also for, he was responsible for the U.S. coup in Chile. I mean, I'm going to post some articles just about his tenure as, one of the premier ghouls of American imperialism. he helped orchestrate the plot to overthrow Salvador Allende in Chile and bring in Pinochet, which, you know, that went very well. I mean, yeah, they successfully overthrew Allende and put in Pinochet. Yeah, he also supported apartheid in South Africa. Him and Gerald Ford gave Suharto in Indonesia the green light to invade East Timor, which resulted in over like 200,000 deaths, which is almost like 1/4 of the population. I mean, he just, the man had a ton of blood on his hands, and like I said, the articles we're gonna share go more in depth, but that's just to kind of give you a snippet of how just incredibly cynical he was and how much blood he has on his hands. And the whole like speak ill of the dead, well, I mean, I think that only applies if said person, the deceased, was actually a good person and actually like did good for the world, which that doesn't apply to Henry Kissinger. I don't understand like what liberals see in Kissinger. But I mean, yeah, the dude was a mass murderer and a war criminal. So I mean, people on the left have been waiting for him to die. because yeah, he was just getting so old and like, when is this guy gonna kick the bucket? And he finally did. But one could also argue that he lived a little bit too long. I mean, he lived up to see 100, so. I mean, good fucking riddance to him. But, I really have nothing. I have nothing nice to say about Kissinger. He was a despicable person. I want to say that the world is better off without him. But given that there's so much, you know, fucked up shit going on in the world, I don't know how much that applies, because yeah, like things in the world are already bad, so it's not like his death materially makes things any better, but it's good that he's no longer with us.
Because we don't have.
Yeah, I just want to add in a few things. Which is that like. Speaking of overthrowing people, one that like really does get overlooked is in Cambodia, which is Prince Sihanouk, who was sort of the nationalist secular leader of Cambodia, who kept Cambodia neutral out of the war in Vietnam, you know, obviously was not going to let the U.S. carpet bomb his country into total rubble. So they overthrew him and put in a dictator called Lon Nol, you know, your classic puppet, who I guess didn't really have a problem with the U.S. carpet bombing the country. But what is one of the significant things about that is that the Communist Party of Kampuchea, when Prince Sihanouk was still in power, was waging more of a legalistic campaign. You know, they're not doing armed struggle until he was overthrown and Lon Nol, fascist dictator, was put in. And that's when they started engaging in armed struggle and eventually became, you know them better as the Khmer Rouge, which is to say that Henry Kissinger's responsibility is almost twofold for the amount of deaths he's responsible for is essentially equal to the amount that the Khmer Rouge is responsible for, but also, like, doubly, he created the conditions that not only led the Khmer Rouge to come to power, but also that they took sort of the tactics that they did. And it's important to also stress that Kissinger bears basically singular responsibility for this policy, because he very much, he's a bit of a charmer. And Nixon, you know, didn't really like the bureaucracy and really didn't like the CIA for obvious reasons, considering they ended up Watergating him. But so he was able to convince Nixon to basically bypass the usual foreign policy apparatus, which, you know, not really, you know, an institution of restraint or anything, but still had its, like, bureaucratic inertia and checks and stuff. And they ran the foreign policy purely out of the White House. And so it was entirely his idea. And it's important to remember that's not just that. And it's the same thing with, like, Rumsfeld. It's not just that these people, like, you know, rack up death counts in the high six figures to low seven figures. It's that, like, they also failed at whatever they were trying to do. Like, he destroyed a country for nothing. Like, that it did. And that's the thing, is that, like, it's a very good tell if anyone considers Kissinger, like, a great statesman, because he's really not. The reason that people think of it is because, A, nobody in America has any idea what a great statesman actually is, because there's no statesmanship in this fucking country. And second, he was very good at being a celebrity. I mean, he was after he, you know, would have a hard day's work harvesting the souls of Cambodian peasants, he was then getting lit at Studio 54. You know, this was the 70s, baby. And so that's just the kind of guy he was. And it's important, I feel like, is he, you know, on some level, is he not really that different than all the other Dr. Strangelove types that comprise the national security apparatus? But he was sort of, he deserves a little extra scorn for just taking things to another level, because he may be the biggest narcissist in American history. And that's, you know, that's a bold claim, and I think anyone is welcome to offer counterexamples, but he's definitely up there, top five at least. So I just wanted to sort, because I feel like that stuff, when people talk about, like, the secret, because it was secret, because the press didn't cover it, people don't necessarily understand what it is that was done, but they leveled a country that didn't do anything for quote-unquote real politic, which ultimately didn't do anything, didn't, like, make the U.S. any more successful in what it was trying to do in Vietnam. And the idea that, you know, he single-handedly opened up China, like, he didn't create Dengism, guys. He did not. It was going to happen one way or the other, you know, because in the set, it was up until, like, 1973 that the seat of China at the UN Security Council was held by Taiwan. I mean, that was going to get corrected at some point. So, you know, he really doesn't deserve credit for any of the things that people even think is good. And Michael S. Judge on Death Around, Just Around the Corner made a very good point, which is that even out of office, he probably did even more damage by creating, like, his own little academy and, you know, mentorship programs. And he went on, you know, he's like Belichick, you know, he had a coaching tree of all the next generation of ghouls. So it's like threefold, actually. So anyway, enough about him. But yes, yeah. Moving on to the current genocide going on.
Yeah, yeah, and I just want to mention just some important context about Cambodia. Like, the stated reason for basically conducting a secret illegal war in Cambodia and then also Laos was that the U.S. alleged that North Vietnamese troops were using neighboring Cambodia as a logistics hub.
The same way Hamas was using a hospital as a logistics hub.
Right, yeah, and so kind of like, yeah, similar to Israel-Palestine, that was just used to, like, just kill more civilians. That's really what happened in Cambodia, is just a lot of innocent civilians were killed, like hundreds of thousands to, like, up to a million people. And there is, even though, like, the press didn't cover at the time, like, 50 years afterward, there's been a lot more reporting and writing and coverage of like what actually happened. So like I said, I'm gonna put some articles in the show notes for people to dig in more into the details of what actually happened during the Vietnam War and the US's secret bombing of Cambodia and Southeast Asia. But anyway, yeah, let's talk about like the current ongoing bloodbath. Should we talk about was it the fucking the presidents of let's talk about that.
Yes, yes, the most important thing in this conflict is the quote-unquote rise of anti-Semitism on college campuses, and the university president congressional hearing. That's clearly the most pressing part of the conflict. But it is, it is for the U.S. media because they need something to talk about other than just ongoing mass slaughter.
Yeah, so what's been happening basically, Congress is putting forth some resolutions. One of them entails conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And, well, you know, in terms of like, you know, as of this day of us recording, December 10th, 2023, Israel has killed like over 17,000 Palestinians, most of them civilians. The bombardment of Gaza still continues. And there's also this article about Israel's mass assassination factory that I want to dig into a little bit, because it spells out how basically Israel is using artificial intelligence to compile like a list of targets to bomb in Gaza, which has led to so many the massive civilian death toll in Gaza. But anyway, because of like what's been going on, you know, what we've been seeing since October 7th, and this bombardment has been going on for over two months as we speak, there have been more protests across the country, much more so than like this is unusual. It is very unusual to see like this number of Americans come protest in solidarity with Palestinians, because of social media, particularly on Instagram and TikTok, more Americans are able to see the actual suffering of Palestinians at the hand of Israel, and it's enraging a lot of people, particularly people under the age of like 45 and people of color. Like there's some polling done showing that the majority of millennials and Zoomers and the majority of non-whites are sympathetic with Palestinians. And so there have been similar protests on college campuses. And there are members of the mainstream media and people in Congress who are conflating those protests, which are calling for a ceasefire and justice for Palestinians, with anti-Semitism and support, and particularly like support for Hamas. So basically what they're trying to say is that any sympathy with Palestinians means sympathy with Hamas and sympathy with terrorism and anti-Semitism. So they're they're doing a lot of conflating here. So there have been some congressional hearings with the presidents of MIT, Harvard, and University of Pennsylvania about allegations of anti-Semitism, and basically questioning how these universities are responding to, you know, what they're calling is anti-Semitism on campus. Now, I want to be clear, like, you know, this is not to say that anti-Semitism isn't real, and like I want to make that clear that anti-Semitism is a very real thing, and I think people who are already anti-Semitic, I can imagine jumping onto this issue as a way to justify their hatred of Jewish people, but I want to remind people listening to this podcast that there are a lot of Jewish people who are very critical of Israel. In fact, like the article that we'll delve into later in 972 magazine is written by a Jewish person, an Israeli, in fact. So, like, there are Jews, Israelis, who are very critical of the actions of Israel, and there are a lot of anti-Zionist Jewish people who basically say that Israel's actions don't, like, are not in line with Judaism. So that's, I want to say that very, very clearly, because you can be critical of Israel without, like, you know, hating Judaism as a religion or Jewish people in general. And my firm belief is that Israel's actions, they don't represent Jewish people. And, you know, so I want to make that very clear, especially as we talk about this. I can imagine, like, yeah, there might be a handful of people who might be latching onto some of these protests, but the point of the protests, it's been very clear, which is calling for a ceasefire, ending the conflict, and justice for Palestinians. And to see those very reasonable demands be conflated with anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews, I just think is incredibly grotesque. But that's what these hearings are about. And so, yeah, there's been congressional hearings with these presidents. Basically, what's happening is that they are facing threats from donors and demands that the presidents resign because they're not responding to anti-Semitism on campus. And so, that's why there are these congressional hearings. But, you know, university presidents, they're just hedge fund managers. You know, they don't really... universities, especially those above, like, the community college level, like, they're so incredibly subservient to their donor class, and, like, that's how universities are actually run. So, there was, like, basically, because students were saying, "Long live the Intifada," that's like the evidence they're saying that, oh, there's anti-Semitism on campus. When Intifada, as a word in Arabic, just means, like, to shake off or uprising. Like, they're conflating that with genocide.
Yes, no, this is the furor that broke out was, and, you know, all congressional hearings are basically pointless. They're just clout grabs for... shit-kicking Congress people that want a chance in the spotlight, and the person that was running this is no different. But yes, it was the presidents of Harvard, MIT, and Penn, you know, so the elites, which there are, you know, the pages of the Wall Street Journal, especially, but, you know, in the New York Times, they always just, because that's where most of them went to college, they love to just complain about, you know, what's going on. I think it's so that it's their weird version of reliving their college days when, like, they yelled at some liberal leftist activists at a party one time, and they want to reclaim that because, you know, I think that's why they obsess about it, because, like, it doesn't fucking matter. Other than, you know, that those universities are also where the next generation of ghouls are trained. But, you know, usually the theory behind, like, especially elite education is that you want the elites to actually know the truth, even if they go on and destroy it in their careers. Like, a system, you know, the people running it on some level have to be grounded in reality. So that's why your universities are allowed to, like, you know, teach controversial issues. But yes, those presidents, this woman asked if you know, she was talking about the phrase "long live the Intifada," and you know, especially the first Intifada was like civil disobedience, and you know, they all like in both of the instances, like the Intifadas turned violent because of Israeli repression. So let's be clear about that. And you know, she was saying that saying "long live the Intifada" means calling for the genocide of all Jews, and she was saying that does, and basically the university presidents wouldn't take the bait and say that's hate speech because these people aren't even like quiet about what their actual aim is, which is silencing all pro-Palestinian voices, basically outlawing, or I mean, it's so stupid because they're never going to like remove the federal funding of, you know, the elite colleges. But I can certainly imagine how this filters down, especially in Florida, where DeSantis like is actively trying to deport all students in all anyone who's in Students for Justice in Palestine and like get every iteration of that group off of every college in Florida. So that's like, I mean, it's hilarious because, you know, 2 years ago, these were like the fucking free speech warriors, and now they are doing the exact opposite. And so, yes, they had their old field day, and the president of Penn resigned, but part of that was also just like, she wasn't very popular anyway. So, once again, and important to remember, a lot of times, whenever like this kind of stuff blows up about like some, you know, basically office drama at a college campus, it's like, yeah, when someone gets canceled, it's usually because somebody wanted them gone anyway, and they're just using you know, cancel culture, quote unquote, as an excuse to get rid of them. So that's basically what happens. But I also, yeah, it's just incredibly, it's just a good indicator of what, you know, the chatter in class feels is a worthwhile use of their time, which is getting that at college. And it's just like, you know, it does just, for me, it just drives home the point that maybe we should just get rid of college if this is how people want to behave. Clearly, like, this is too much for any of these people to handle. Because, like, I mean, both of us were on a college campus, you know, like, we were on the ground doing this kind of stuff, you know, longer ago than maybe we'd like to admit. But, like, we know how the, we know this game is played, and, like, you, like, it's actually beneficial to keep this stuff, like, cloistered and relegated to these small, you know, because these universities are usually not that big, like, compared to sort of the massive state universities that have, like, 50,000 people at them. And so it's actually, like, once again, these idiots are too stupid to, like, think beyond, you know, the next news cycle, because it's, like, it's actually beneficial to coordinate off into, you know, these areas and not, like, you know, and not turn these people into martyrs and, like, that kind of stuff, because it's just, it is quite silly. But, yeah, I think that's probably all I have to say. I was working at a university dining hall yesterday, and, like, on the way out, I saw, like, this, there's, like, a satirical student newspaper, and I guess they had become significantly less satirical and had written a, like, a response about the issue to the university administrator. And, like, most university administrators are quote-unquote classical liberals in the sense of, like, they're right-wing. Like, they're, these campuses are not havens of radicalism and communism.
No, we know that firsthand.
We know that firsthand. That hasn't changed. And anyway, a bunch of people, I guess, that the previous day, like, somebody had thrown a bunch of that I mean, it was just like a printout of like an 8.5 of them, but they had thrown them in the trash. And so then the next day, the newspaper then printed like to all the people that threw this in the trash, like, this, what's wrong with you? And I feel like these are the kind of things that get reported as anti-Semitism. And the reason I'm not trying to deny anyone's lived experience, because nobody can ever tell somebody that they didn't feel a certain way, okay? And feeling unsafe is something you can't argue with, because it's a feeling. But if there were any, like, actual egregious incidents of this stuff, like, you would actually hear about them. And every actual incident I've heard has been mostly people being mad about Israel and Israelis and,
yeah,
you know...
Yeah,
it's not really what the kind of thing that the media is hyping it up to be.
Yeah, and also let's say the case is like where someone is being overtly anti-Semitic, like even people within like the Palestine Solidarity Movement, like they're pretty good at shutting that person down. Like, hey, like, you know, so. This is what makes the conflation between calls for a ceasefire and calls for Palestinian justice, conflating that with anti-Semitism, incredibly ridiculous, because, like, the people who are overtly anti-Semitic, it gets shut down, like, pretty quickly, and people within the movement are pretty clear about distancing themselves from people who are overtly anti-Semitic, and like, you know,
or covertly anti-Semitic.
Yeah, and so like, yeah, even covertly, yeah, because you know, people don't. That's not what the point is. Like the point of calling for justice for Palestinians and ending of apartheid in Israel is not about like trying to destroy Jewish people. Like that's not the beef. Like Jews as a people are not the enemy, right? You know, so yeah, that needs to be made very clear that, yeah, this movement, these calls for a ceasefire have nothing to do with painting all Jews as the enemy. And people within the movement are pretty clear about distancing themselves from people who are overtly or covertly anti-Semitic. So, yeah, and you know, universities I taught 5 years English at the community college level, which is a little different, definitely, than like, you know, these Ivy League universities. But I think like my hot take on universities. It's not necessarily, I'm not opposed to their existence. I just don't like how they're actually run, because universities are run like businesses at this point. Because I do see a value in having institutions of higher learning where that knowledge is for a public good and a social good. And that's also been part of like, because the idea of a university goes back like nearly 1,000 years, and having institutions of higher learning where that knowledge is for the public good, I think is a good thing. It's just the way universities are run now, as we speak, have moved far away from that goal. And the whole point of universities is, like, they're just run like businesses, because... like, the product is the college experience and not actually learning. And even going to, like, the whole free speech thing, yeah, I find it very hypocritical that a lot of these right-wingers who previously were a bunch of, like, free speech warriors now, but then when it comes to Palestine, it's like, oh, free speech goes out the window. Then it's about, like, safety on campus and how safe one feels when, like, you know, when students were protesting, like, the alt-right, they were like, oh, well, you know, it's about free speech. But then now the students are protesting for Palestinians, like, oh, you know, we need to be concerned about campus safety. And like, so yeah, the right-wing free speech warriors are incredibly silent when it comes to free speech for for Palestinians. But yeah, like universities, like I said, they're run like businesses. And the product is the college experience, and the customers are the students. And the people who really call the shots at universities, who really have the most power, it's not the students, it's not even really the alumni, it's really like major donors. Like, that's who really holds most of power. And universities like, you know, like our alma mater, Stanford University, which is the same thing for Harvard and Penn and whatnot, they're governed by a board of trustees who are incredibly unaccountable to definitely the broader public and definitely to the students and alumni. So, like, that structure is why, you know, we're seeing the response from university presidents, because they're not concerned about free speech or campus safety or making sure that the universities stay in line with the goal of higher learning. Like, this is about making sure that the donors are happy. So yeah, the job of a university president, especially at the Ivy League level, like, you're just a fucking hedge fund manager at that point. Like, you're not a leader of higher learning, you know what I mean? Like that's not the job of a fucking university president. The job of a university president is to, you're just a hedge fund manager.
To solicit donations. And yeah, I just want to clarify, and then we can move on.
Yeah.
That, yes, institutions of higher learning for the public good are an important part of any thriving, functioning society. But, you know, the point of an elite college that is private is to create a place for, like, those colleges aren't elite because they're just better than all the other colleges. They're elite because they educate the children of the elite. And
yep.
And the point is to have this, like, holy sanctuary place where they can go and learn what it is this is, you know, the powers that be want them to know so they can be better equipped to run society away from society. So they don't like it when the real world intrudes into, I mean, that's the whole point of why campuses look like that and all that stuff. And, you know, the manicured quad and everything and the romance around it is for that reason. Because, you know, community colleges don't look like that.
They definitely don't. No.
Yeah, so that's why I said, like, those things, I don't think the people really need them. And especially if this is how everyone's going to behave. And it's just like, guys, it's just like, it really is like how columnists and talking heads relive their college days is talking about this crap. Moving on.
Yeah.
Those elite universities are just like, it's summer camp for spoiled rich kids. And yeah, legacy admissions, all that. But anyway, so keeping in line with like what we're talking about with Israel Palestine, there is this really long but incredibly well reported and researched article called "A Mass Assassination Factory Inside Israel's Calculated Bombing of Gaza." This is in 972 magazine. By the way, for those of you who don't know 972 magazine, they're really good. So they actually, it's an independent online nonprofit magazine run by Palestinian and Israeli journalists. They were founded in 2010, and they do a lot of in-depth reporting, analysis, and opinion about Israel Palestine. So, a lot of their reporters and writers are, a lot of them are Israeli, a lot of them are Palestinian. So if you want, good coverage of Israel Palestine that's not from, you know, a U.S. point of view, but is actually from like a more on the ground independent perspective, 972 magazine is a really good site. I recommend reading what they have on there, especially for folks. And I want to say this, especially for folks who this issue is new for. Like if you haven't been paying attention to Israel Palestine in the last, like, let's say 15 years, and have just started paying attention to it more, especially in light of the events of October 7th, 972 magazine, is 972mag.com. They're really good. Anyway, so this article is in 972 magazine. It's by Yuval Abraham. It was published November 30th, 2023, so not too long ago, like 2 weeks ago. I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs for it, basically like the first part of it, and then we can discuss it, because the reason why I think this article is incredibly good and important to read is because it lays out how Israel is carrying out so many bombings of civilian and non-military targets, and why that, like, I think it puts it pokes a major hole in the idea of Israel being the most moral army, in that it's trying its best to make distinctions between civilians and combatants. This is clearly, like, as this article shows, that is not the case. Israel knows that it's bombing civilians, but it's bombing civilian targets anyway. And the point is to basically shock the civilian population of Gaza to turn away from Hamas. So I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs and then we'll discuss it. The Israeli army's expanded authorization for bombing non-military targets, the loosening of constraints regarding expected civilian casualties, and a use of an artificial intelligence system to generate more potential targets than ever before appear to have contributed to the destructive nature of the initial stages of Israel's current war on the Gaza Strip, an investigation by 972 magazine and Local Call reveals. These factors, as described by current and former Israeli intelligence members, have likely played a role in producing what has been one of the deadliest military campaigns against Palestinians since the Nakba of 1948. The investigation by 972 and Local Call is based on conversations with seven current and former members of Israel's intelligence community, including military intelligence and Air Force personnel who were involved in Israeli operations in the besieged Strip. In addition to Palestinian testimonies, data, and documentation from the Gaza Strip, and official statements by the IDF spokesperson and other Israeli state institutions. Compared to previous Israeli assaults on Gaza, the current war, which Israel has named Operation Iron Swords, and which began in the wake of the Hamas-led assault on southern Israel on October 7th, has seen the military expand its bombing of targets that are not distinctively military in nature. These include private residences, as well as public buildings, infrastructure, and high-rise blocks, which sources say the army defines as power targets. The bombing of power targets, according to intelligence sources who had first-hand experience with this application of Gaza in Gaza in the past, is mainly intended to harm Palestinian civil society to, quote, create a shock that, among other things, will reverberate powerfully and, quote, lead civilians to put pressure on Hamas, end quote, as one source put it. Several of the sources who spoke to 972 and Local Call on the condition of anonymity confirmed that the Israeli army has files on the vast majority of potential targets in Gaza, including homes, which stipulate the number of civilians who are likely to be killed in an attack on a particular target. This number is calculated and known in advance to the army's intelligence units, who also know shortly before carrying out an attack roughly how many civilians are certain to be killed. In one case discussed by the sources, the Israeli military command knowingly approved the killing of hundreds of Palestinian civilians in an attempt to assassinate a single top Hamas military leader. Quote, the numbers increased from dozens of civilian deaths permitted as collateral damage as part of an attack on a senior official in previous operations to hundreds of civilian deaths as collateral damage, end quote, said one source. Quote, nothing happens by accident, said another source. Quote, when a three-year-old girl is killed in a home in Gaza, it's because someone in the army decided it wasn't a big deal for her to be killed, that it was a price worth paying in order to hit another target. We are not Hamas. These are not random rockets. Everything is intentional. We know exactly how much collateral damage there is in every home, end quote. According to the investigation, another reason for the large number of targets and the extensive harm to civilian life in Gaza is a widespread use of a system called Habsora, which translates to the gospel, which is largely built on artificial intelligence and can generate targets almost automatically at a rate that far exceeds what was previously possible. This AI system, as described by a former military intelligence officer, essentially facilitates a mass assassination factory. According to the sources, the increasing use of AI-based systems like Habsora allows the army to carry out strikes on residential homes where a single Hamas member lives on a massive scale, even those who are junior Hamas operatives. Yet testimonies of Palestinians in Gaza suggest that since October 7th, the army has also attacked many private residences where there was no known or apparent member of Hamas or any other local militant group residing. Such strikes, sources confirmed to 972 and local call, can knowingly kill entire families in the process. In the majority of cases, the sources added, military activity is not conducted from these targeted homes. Quote, I remember thinking that it was like if Palestinian militants would bomb all the private residences of our families when Israeli soldiers go back to sleep at home on the weekend, end quote, one source who was critical of the practice recalled. Another source that said that senior intelligence officers told his officers after October 7th that the goal was to, quote, kill as many Hamas operatives as possible, end quote, for which the criteria among harming Palestinian civilians were significantly relaxed. As such, there are, quote, cases in which we shell based on a wide cellular pinpointing of where the target is, killing civilians. This is often done to save time instead of doing a little more work to get more accurate pinpointing, end quote, said the source. This is a very long article. I encourage everybody to read the whole thing, but essentially, Israel, in order to get a, like, what's called, like, paint a target when you're bombing, you know, one way is to, like, have, like, an asset on the ground to determine, like, okay, this building or this place has these, you know, military targets, and we call in air support to bomb them. But even with this ground invasion, Israel figures it's too risky to do that because they don't want to get in, like, a large firefight with Palestinian militants. So they have these, essentially, artificial intelligence systems that are based on an even more sophisticated collection of, like, cell phone metadata and other forms of electronic and signals intelligence that can generate a list of coordinates and targets for Israel to drop bombs on. And as this article shows, they know which places have civilian targets. They know, like, the likelihood of civilians being killed and the number of civilians that will be killed. But Israel will bomb those sites anyway and risk of civilian casualties because the idea is not even just to, like, pinpoint a Hamas target. So, like, the whole human shield thing, like, is complete bullshit here. Because they will bomb targets where they know that there's no Hamas leader or any other militant leader, and that they know there are civilians. Like, they've bombed those sites. The goal of this, as this article shows, is to shock the Palestinians and the people of Gaza enough that they will turn against Hamas. Now, to me, that sounds like terrorism.
It is. I mean, yes, like it is the classic definition of terrorism, which is, yes, using violence to instill terror in a population to achieve a political goal. Yep. I just also want to say, God damn, these motherfuckers are lazy. Like, I was glad in that quote you said, you know, they do it to save time, and you know, it ain't like the OG, you know, IBM computers during the Holocaust where they had to, like, sit there and do the punch cards to create the list of names. Now it's fucking genocide by ChatGPT. That's awesome. No, it's not awesome. But yeah, it's a good indicator just like how lazy and bloated this thing is. By this thing, I mean the Israeli death machine, because they don't even want to waste the time. I mean, there aren't like really strategic targets in Gaza. You know, it's all civilian infrastructure, and they consider all governmental infrastructure to be part of Hamas because, you know, Hamas runs social services. So that's all, like, in their minds, everything's a legitimate target. And
yeah,
any child killed, especially any male child killed, is just a future Hamas member anyway. And if the idea is to, I mean, the idea is to get them to turn against Hamas, that seems to not be working, because also, like, you know, if Israel destroys your entire family, then obviously you're going to, like, go join the one organization that lets you fight the people that just killed your entire family. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it is always important to remember that, like, campaigns of maximum brutality undermine security. They do not enhance it. And I think over, you know, and this is really no different than the way the police have behaved in American cities, just on a more extreme level. And yeah, that's all I got at the moment. But yeah, it's just, goddamn, these people are lazy. It's all signals intelligence. It's all, you know, signals intelligence is just tracking phones. They don't have to put in the work that, you know, the OG Kissinger types. I mean, that was like real, genocidal statecraft. These days, it's just, they draw up a list via ChatGPT, and they don't, it's not like there's an accountability. It's not like there's a, you know, if the algorithm was wrong, they don't care. I mean, if anything, like, they need to juice, you know, death counts and these kinds of things at this point are figured out by computers in advance. I mean, that's how wars are conducted in the 21st century. Even in the late 20th, I mean, even in Vietnam, you know, when Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, was known for, like, you know, this having this vast computer system that would, you know, identify targets or whatever. Like, and there's the idea of, you know, the amount of a death toll that is, like, quote unquote, acceptable. And so in the American mind, and in the Israeli mind, like, the death toll right now is acceptable. It doesn't matter. That's like, they've agreed, you know, that they probably have, like I said at the beginning, when all this shit started, they probably have to get to like 50 to 100,000, so that Netanyahu's base feels satisfied or something. But it is about like computer administrated bloodlust. I mean, there really is no strategic goal that is, you know, because this will go on as long as there's political cover for it to go on. And, you know, America just sent a bunch of tank ammunition to Israel. The idea that America is exercising some sort of restraining influence on Israel while also arming them to the teeth is obviously absurd. And it is hilarious to watch these State Department ghouls, you know, get on TV and try to justify it. And I think some of them are cracking, because, like, if you're, you know, one of the best and brightest out of one of the nation's elite colleges, and, you know, you still have some youthful idealism, you want to work in the State Department, and this is your job, like, at some point you're like, you know, you're still a millennial or, you know, Zillennial. I mean, we got Gen Zers up here now at this point, doing these press conferences. Like, you're like, I didn't sign up for this, man. Most of them, I think. And so it is like, this will go on until there is essentially a deafening cry from the rest of the world that it has to stop. I mean, that's like, I think that's a completely materialist, empirical understanding of where the conflict is at this point.
Yeah, and excuse me. Also, there was a UN resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, and guess who vetoed it? America, the United States. So, yeah. So, like, the United States is probably the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East because of its position on the Security Council, it can veto these resolutions, which is done routinely. It's like there have been numerous resolutions in the UN condemning Israel's actions that the U.S. just vetoes. As for this article, one thing I want to say is that this is very similar to U.S. drone strikes and how they're conducted because, targets for the war on terror to basically be assassinated by a drone strike. The intelligence for that is gathered by cell phone metadata. So it's not looking at the contents of the call, but it's basically tracing one's movements based on tracking a SIM card. Basically, your SIM card in your... tracking the SIM card in a cell phone and tracing the movements of the SIM card. Because the thing is that one of the biggest flaws with tracking SIM cards is that you can take out a SIM card in a cell phone and give it to somebody else. And so, you could be... intentionally target a person just because they have a cell phone, but they could easily give their cell phone to somebody else or remove the SIM card. But basically it's tracking the SIM card to come up with a pattern of behavior, and that was used particularly by the Obama administration to determine, oh, okay, well, this person's a terrorist and so we can kill them. And you could like the flaws in that are pretty easy to like I was just talking about, easy to detect, and that you could very easily get the wrong person or kill civilians. So now, like, where we're at, we're at, like, another stage with artificial intelligence that the algorithm and the computer analysis is becoming more sophisticated, because what I was talking about, with drone strikes, that was done largely, almost 10 years ago, like in the 2010s when Obama was in office. Now, like, the technology has become more sophisticated, that these sorts of targets can be done a little more automatically. So, but this is how Israel is killing large numbers of civilians in Gaza, and they know they're killing large numbers of civilians, and that is part of the strategy. So that's why I said that it's not just terrorism, but this is really like state terrorism, because the goal of Israel to bomb civilians is to basically get them to turn against Hamas. So these are war crimes. This obviously flies in the face of international law and international humanitarian law. Like the importance of distinction and proportionality, like this completely flies in the fucking face of that, So Israel's violating international law and international humanitarian law, and it's just committing war crimes. These are war crimes, of a very blatant order, and the U.S. is not just backing it through military support, but also political support at the U.N. And for those of us in the United States, really the best we can do is to not let up, because it is heart-wrenching to see these images of dead Palestinians, and to hear Palestinian journalists and writers and poets and just be killed by Israel for it's obscene. We're getting close to the end, but I don't want to end on super doom and gloom. The one thing I want to say to kind of close it out is, I think it's heartening to see the number of everyday Americans come out protesting in support of Palestinians and sharing this information and speaking out against it and doing whatever we can to to, you know, stand up for what's right. So I think it's heartening to see that, and I think, you know we can't give up that fight. Do you have anything else to say, Peter? Or
I'll try to make it quick because I have to get out of here. But yeah, you know, I think there's Blinken is still running with this idea of we'll just put the PA back in charge of Palestinian Authority. Israel's not going to sign off on that. And the Palestinian Authority does not have the capability or the popular legitimacy to administer Gaza. that, you know, at that point, I mean, at most Palestinians consider them as, you know, collaborators in the occupation in the West Bank, which is also, you know, going through a series of pogroms and ethnic cleansing and just outright settler violence. Israel, for Israel to be successful, it needs Palestine and Palestinians to not exist for the Zionist project to be successful. And I think that the only thing we have as, you know, regular people is an ability to make the people in power right now in America to face political consequences, because the only thing Biden's really concerned about is if this is going to cost him the election. So you gotta, you know, can't get turned around on this because there's literally nothing that, you know, the MATO watching crowd can moralize to you about this. I'm not telling anyone how to vote or anything, or even anything like that. But you have to be, like, we have to be willing to make Biden pay a political consequence for this just absolutely obscene thing that he's overseeing and running cover for. And, like, yeah, they're not going to pull it out, like, at the end of the day, Israel's going to do what it wants, and America's going to sign off on it. It doesn't matter if they feel weird about it at the end of the day. So I don't know. I mean, I guess that's hopeful. It's I think earlier in this podcast, you know, in the last election cycle, whatever, I talked about, like, it's not about, like, hope, it's about resolve. So, you know, strengthen your resolve. Because, like, if solidarity actually means anything, then we have to carry this through after it just, disappears from the headlines. So, I think we gotta go because the library is closing.
Okay, yeah, well, anyway, I think that's a great way to end it. Yeah, it's about resolve, not hope. So, yeah, don't keep up the resolve. So, anyway, yeah, thank you guys so much for listening to us. This is Real Sankar Hours. If you want to support us, realsankarhours.org. For $5 a month, you can become a patron and get access to free episodes. $3 a month, you can just be a patron, but you don't have access to free episodes. And you can also make a one-time donation to us. But, you know, we're not a nonprofit. We are a worker cooperative LLC, so just to make that clear. So donations are not tax deductible, but any financial support you can give us keeps this podcast going. So anyway, on the theme of resolve, keep the faith
and stay dangerous.
All right, take care.